Okay, welcome to the joint session of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision and the Committee on Access and Transportation. I'm Gene Lozano. I'm the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation. And also to my right is Bernice Kandarian, the president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. Before we open, start our workshop and give you an idea what's going to transpire in the next 3 hours, approximately, it might be less, depending on the interest, I'm going to ask Bernice if she has any comments that she'd like to make, opening comments. Bernice?
Good morning. I just want to welcome all the low vision people to this very important issue of destination elevators, and I hope that you enjoy the session.
Thank you. The purpose of this workshop is for us to become more educated, or in some cases, educated on the development of the advancement of a new elevator control system. This system is based on destination based dispatching. Our speakers will talk about what that is, but the elevator controller, which is basically the brain of the elevator, with this new advancement, it will be not know where you want to go before you enter the elevator. And then when you enter the elevator as a passenger, the controller, it will send you to the floor that you have requested. Now, one of the features is before you have entered the car, the elevator controller will have choices of which elevator to direct you to. And it'll be looking at what is the most effective and efficient way of transporting you to that floor. So as you will hear, input information as to what floor you want to go to in the elevator lobby, the elevator controller will know what floor. And then it will tell you which elevator to go to, and then you go into the elevator, and then it will send you to that floor direct, or there might be some intermediate stops if there's other people, but it will do it in the most efficient way. There are considered benefits, and our speakers will talk about what are the benefits. Some of them are green, energy conservation. This is technology, as you can tell, is much different from what we're acquainted with right now, where you go into the elevator lobby, you push the call button, elevator comes to that floor, you go inside, you push the floor you want, and then you go to that floor. There's several steps, and it may take a lot longer, especially when it's very busy. What we hope is, again, is to educate all of us on this subject. The outcome is that this workshop, we're hoping, will be the beginning of a dialogue between the elevator industry and other stakeholders so that we can eventually come up with standards for the state of California that could be put incorporated into the California Building Code, and that that it's usable by all parties. We have there some changes that have occurred since the publication of the announcement about this workshop. One of our speakers, Richard Scaff, from Designing Accessible Communities from Mill Valley, California, due to a medical problem, was unable to attend. He was hoping to give the perspective of how this technology needs to be designed and to meet the accessibility needs of all different disabilities, including those with physical disabilities. I'm certain that we, with time, will be receiving his input on that. What we have, the overview is that we have several representatives from the elevator industry. And first we'll others, and I will at least give you an overview of who's present, and then we'll start our panel. And I apologize to start off with to our speakers with the pronunciation of their names. Nicole Saloyo, thank you, is wearing two hats. She's wearing the hat of the National Elevator Industries Incorporated, and she'll explain what that organization is. She's also the manager of destination products for the Schindler Elevator Company. We also will have a presentation from Ed Perseco, general manager of the Otis Elevator Company in, office in San Francisco. And then Nicole will give a presentation about the Schindler's company's product. Now, her first presentation will... I'm sorry. I'm just distracted with on something. After the elevator companies give their presentations and we hear from NEI, then we will have questions, give you an opportunity to ask questions about the technology and requirements that do exist on the national level. Following that, we will have then a presentation of Josh Mealy, associate scientist from the Smith-Kettlewell Eye Research Institute in San Francisco, who, as a scientist, will give you his observations from having looked at this technology and recommendations he has to offer. Our next presenter would be Jesse Lorenz, who is the Director of Public Policy and Information for the San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired in San Francisco. And she will talk about her agencies, their opinions, observations, and recommendations in this technology. I will, as an advocate, give some impressions that I have from having seen only one installation site in Washington, D.C. on April 4th. And then there'll be questions there. And then after those questions, satisfy the questions from Josh, Jesse, and myself, then we're going to open it up to not free-for-all, but a lively discussion, because I know immediately, like I was initially, there's some fear of the unknown, and I think you're going to find that after you get some of this knowledge and understanding, that you're going to find that this technology has a lot of benefits, and that it's very encouraging, just that we have to be certain that access issues are addressed and that it's user-friendly for all of us, with or without disabilities. We will have opportunity for the audience to ask questions and for panelists to ask questions to the audience. And we have in the audience, I understand, many representatives from other elevator companies who are very interested in getting our input. This is a prime opportunity for us to share with one another, and hopefully we will then start the development of a technology that is fully accessible for everyone. So I would like to ask that if Nicole could speak on behalf of the National Elevator Industries, give us an overview as to what are the national voluntary and mandatory guidelines on this elevator, destination-based elevator technology.
Well, good morning. As Gene was saying, my name is Nikki Saloyo. I work for Schindler Elevator Corporation as the manager of the Destination Products Department. I'm also here to speak to you as the spokesperson for NEI, which is the National Elevator Industry Incorporated. Basically, what that is, a little short explanation, is all the major elevator companies get together and discuss, you know, the industry, changes in the industry, changes in products, code, so forth. I know Gene had been speaking a little bit earlier about destination-based elevator systems. How many people in here have actually ever heard of that? A couple? Okay. Okay. Destination dispatching. Okay. Well, let me start with just a little explanation of the elevator industry over the past, well, I guess it's 100 years now. When elevators were invented, the basic operation was a person standing inside the elevator with you and what floor do you want to go to. And they work a little lever and they take you to the floor that you want to go to. As years have progressed and technology developed, they came up with what they called a conventional elevator system, which is basically what all of us are used to using. You walk up to a button fixture in the hallway. You tell the elevator which way you want to go. Do you want to go up or do you want to go down? You get inside that car, and then there's call buttons on a panel, and you pick which floor you want to go to. Seems pretty simple. Well, as technology has advanced, the brains behind a conventional system. Early conventional systems were what we called relay logic. There's a whole bunch of switches and wires and things up in a machine room, and that's how the elevator knew where to go. As things progressed and we started to get into the computer age, you came up with microprocessors and solid-state type control systems. Now we've kind of gotten to the point where that has gone as far as it's going to go in that particular type of operation. So what's new now, and it has been around for a while, but it's now starting to catch on, is what we call a destination dispatching system. Very simply, you're telling the elevator where you want to go before you actually get inside the elevator. Okay? So why would you even want to do this? Well, it's actually very cool and neat technology when you really understand it. Today, especially in office buildings, everybody comes in at a particular time of day. Just say 8 o'clock in the morning, everybody walks in the building. You walk into the elevator bank and somebody presses a button. There could be two of you standing in the lobby. There could be 50 people standing in the lobby. Now, the way that works is somebody presses a button. The system knows that someone in the lobby or a call from the lobby has been entered. So it sends a car down, one car down. The door's open. Everybody tries to get in. Maybe you get in. Maybe you don't get in. Now, what most people don't understand is you can press that button all you want. It's only sending one car down there. Okay? So you cannot register another requirement into the system until that elevator leaves the lobby. Now, say you're one of the lucky few that actually get in that elevator. Maybe you're stopping once, depending on what floor you're going to. Or maybe you're the poor guy that needs to go to the top, and you're stopping 5 or 6, 7, 8 times to get upstairs. See? We got people in the crowd that experience this. So, now you've waited in the lobby. Now you're waiting in the car. And now if you weren't one of the ones that got in the elevator, you're waiting even longer because you got to wait for another car to come. Now, when you start talking about destination dispatching, when you walk into the lobby, you walk up to an input device. Normally it's a keypad. And you say to the elevator, I want to go to the 15th floor. The person behind you wants to go to the 10th floor. The person next to you wants to go to the 9th floor. Everybody tells the elevator system where they want to go before you get inside the car. So now the system knows I've got 15 people in the lobby. Here's where they're going. It does a calculation, which none of us understand, except the mathematicians, and it chooses 1, 2, 3, 4 cars, however many it's going to take to get everybody to where they need to be the fastest. Why do building owners love it? Well, it's getting people upstairs faster. The complaints from tenants that my people aren't getting the work on time because they're waiting for elevators. We start talking about being green. We start talking about being energy efficient. Well, if the elevator knows how many people want to go somewhere and where they want to go, and it chooses which how many cars to send, and it's not stopping and starting as much, you're not using as much power. Now, the benefits are tremendous to the customer, to the user. The technology and what you can do with it is quite astounding. When you start talking about today, everybody is trying to put way more people inside their building than the building was designed for. So when you start talking about modernizing as opposed to building a new building, you need to come up with a much more efficient way to get people moved around your building. So when you start talking about being able to increase the performance of your elevator system, in some cases it can be 20, 30, 40% improvement over what they already have, simply because the system is running more efficient because it knows who's where and where they want to go. When you start talking about new construction, with the efficiency factor being better, maybe I don't have to put as many elevators inside a building. You know, rentable square footage is a very big deal out there nowadays. Okay, so if I can save space being taken up by elevators, I can put more people inside my building. So basically, we went from the guy in the car running a little lever to you telling the system I want to go up or down, to a very sophisticated system where I know who you are, I know where you want to go, and I'm going to get you up there as fast as I can. Any questions so far? Have I lost anybody? Go ahead right here in the front.
You just said that you know where, you know who they are. Are there office systems with scan cards that you slide the card into the input device and the input device knows?
You know, it's funny you should say that. Yes, actually. Most of the major manufacturers have a card access system. Security, well, not even really security, but access control has kind of become a big deal in buildings. So, yes, there's different devices out there that allow you to identify yourself in some way.
Could that make things easier in with regard to accessibility? Because if all of your information is on the card, then you don't have to worry about whether... I mean, the kiosk should be accessible, but if it's not...
Absolutely. Absolutely. If it happens to know that you may need a little bit more space in the car or you may need a little bit more time to get to the car, let me actually go into a little bit on how it actually works for you as a user, for anybody as a user. You walk up to a keypad input device. When you put your call in, it's just a basic keypad. So if you're on the 14, you would press 1-4. If you happen to press a button, every keypad is equipped with a button. It's an accessibility button. If you happen to press that button, it activates certain features within the system. It's labeled.
Braille.
It's Braille. It has a wheelchair symbol on it. What you would do is you would say you press that button and you'd input your call, and it's going to guide you audibly and visually to where you need to go. Now, when you press that button, it's assuming that you may need a little bit more time to get to your assigned elevator. So we can adjust that. We call that the walk time. So we can adjust the walk time. We can adjust. Maybe we can leave the doors open a little bit longer so that you have more time to get in and out. So and then once you get inside the car is going to speak to you again and guide you through your journey. So it is a very user-friendly system. Did you want to say something, Gene?
Why don't you respond to that question, and then why don't you be able to give your whole presentation? Let's go there, because I think a lot of these questions will be answered, your presentation and Ed's, and then let's do that. But please respond to this one.
Okay, so you lost me. Can you just say it one more time?
Here, let me give you the question.
Okay, the question is, for example, you had 50 people in the lobby. They all go up and punch, you know, what floors they're going to. Are the elevators efficient enough to, do they have the artificial intelligence to say, okay, when one comes down, it'll announce this particular elevator is going to 10, 15, and 20. And so for those people going to those floors, they get on that elevator.
It does not announce what floor it's going to. There's a visual display. If you do hit the accessibility button, it will speak and say car A, doors opening, door closing, those sort of directions. Later on, we'll get into a little bit more on that whole discussion. So that essentially is a very high-level explanation of what destination dispatching is as opposed to conventional systems. Is that okay? Does everybody understand the differences? We're good?
I'd like to ask a question. We've got a convention.
Can everybody hear the microphone? Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. If you've got a large...
Excuse me, Jane. Let's hold off on the question. Let's first have Nicole
finish. She just asked. Just
as the whole concept between destination and conventional.
Okay. I'll just make a brief statement. My question is, we've got a lot of people crowding at a big convention to get in the elevator, and everybody has to take time to put a card in. Isn't that going to create more congestion trying to get on the elevator?
Actually, our experiences have been that it actually doesn't do that. We'll get into it a little bit more when we actually start talking about how things get laid out. But basically what we do, and the entire industry does it. We will go into a particular venue, see the way a building is laid out, see the path of travel within that building, make recommendations on where to put the input devices, because part of the whole problem is exactly what you're speaking about with a conventional system. We've put the system in hotels, and one of the big concerns has always been, when a big convention lets out of a ballroom, what happens? Today what happens is everybody gets mad because they're all crunched in the middle of an elevator lobby pressing an up and down button. So, yes, it actually helps tremendously in that situation because the system knows how many people want to go where, and it'll start to send more cars down to pick you up. Because what I was saying before is the conventional system's only going to send one car down to pick you up because it doesn't know how many people are waiting. If you're in a bank of six elevators and it knows it's got 30 people waiting, it's probably going to send all six elevators down to get those people off of that floor. I mean, that is the actual concept. And you know, that's a very good question because that's exactly the reason, part of the reason that this whole idea came about on how to get people through the buildings and out faster. Okay. I'm good, Gene.
Go on, please.
I'm all set. That was all I was going to say for now.
Do you want to say anything about any of the ANSI or ADEC requirements?
I was actually going to lay off of that for later.
Okay. Then Okay, so then right now, you're finished for now? Then?
I'm finished for now.
Okay. Then I'd like to ask... you got the mic there?
Okay. Sorry.
Mr. Ed Persay?
No, Seiko? There's a million people over here.
From Otis Elevator Company, who's the general manager of the San Francisco office, who was working on this technology on the West Coast.
I'll take it from here, Gene. Thank you very much. If you don't mind, I'm just going to remain seated unless somebody objects to that. But I just I want a formal discussion or a description of what Nikki has probably already provided many of the aspects of destination-based systems. Again, my name is Ed Persico. I'm the general manager for the Otis Elevator Company, located in San Francisco, serving the Bay Area or the Greater Bay Area. I have about 23 years of elevator industry experience, and in the past 2 years have worked extensively with colleagues, with industry consultants, with the disabled community on these new elevator technologies called destination-based elevators. Some of the work that we've done has been with various organizations such as the American Foundation for the Blind. Also worked closely with Smith Kettlewell Eye Research Center, Josh Milley over here. Lighthouse for the Blind with Jesse Lorenz, who's also with us. California Council for the Blind, the TRACE Research and Development Group, as well as the Center for Inclusion Design in the University of Buffalo. So we've spent a lot of time with the integration of this product or this new technology. We've spent a lot of time understanding what our overall objectives are. And the objectives are several, and they serve both the non-disabled community as well as the sight or hearing or mobility impaired community as well. And the impact of these systems has been rather dramatic. We have seen that they do, as Nikki had referred to, improve the overall efficiency of moving people through a building. And that's important from a building standpoint, from an efficiency standpoint of how people get from one location or outside of the building up to their destination floor. But more importantly, I guess, for this group is that it provides an equal or what we refer to as equivalent means of getting from the elevator lobby to your final destination. What we have coined this this new analysis or method of analysis is overall trip time, and that trip time is measured by the time it takes for an individual to begin that interface with an elevator system and arrive at their destination. And that overall time, through the use of this new technology, has been dramatically reduced. And what does that mean for the building community? And Nikki also touched on that, is that it provides great efficiency for building power usage, for movement of people, for less congestion, things of that nature. And how does that serve the disabled community? It provides equivalent facilitation through interfacing with an elevator system, but it also provides better direction. It allows you to determine or to understand where to go rather than taking guesses. So my discussion is just going to be a reiteration of what has already been said, but I'd like to better describe, not better describe, but maybe more intimately describe the differences in the human interface of how we get to our destinations into the building. So, as it was said before, destination-based systems have been around for maybe a decade or so for the most part. I believe that they were They were probably, the technology was invented maybe 30 years ago or more, but has not been widely accepted by the industry, the building community, for the past 10 years. Most recently, within the past several years, there's been an enormous demand for this improved technology, and especially here in the Northern California area. This area, as well as New York or the Eastern area, seem to be the ones that are most interested and the most demanding as far as how these systems perform. So I guess you are the beneficiaries of seeing the latest technology in how people are moved through buildings. And that's a good thing, because we believe that it actually helps that process. What's the overall goal, I guess, is that we are providing enough of an ability for people to get from one destination to the next as easy as possible. And you know how it is. It occurs now. It's simply under the conventional systems. You go into the lobby way, and being a disabled person, you are sharing the lobby and sharing that elevator just by stroking one of the call buttons in the hallway, whether you're going in the up or the down direction, and waiting for the next available car to arrive, where there could be as many as, what Nikki said before, 30, 40, 50 people waiting for the same elevator. And if you are one of the unfortunate or unlucky ones not to get to that elevator, then you have to go back into the lobby way or back to the elevator device and re-stroke that key and wait for the next car, not really knowing ahead of time which car is going to show up. Now, you've all been in high-rise buildings, I'm sure, where there could be 4, 6, 8 elevators. And sometimes the entrances to those elevators could be 20, 30, perhaps even 40 feet away from where you push that button. And you hear a gong go off or an electronic chime. And it is only your only device that enables you to find your way to that elevator that's serving the next passenger group up. With destination-based, as was explained before, your destination is pre-selected. And the hall station that you select your destination with tells you which elevator you're to queue in front of. It gives you the direction to that elevator. So there's no longer any crowding at the entrance of that car, which will assist the accessibility standards, right? It will assist those who are mobility disabled, sight impaired, or hearing impaired by providing a more roomy elevator. You won't have 10, 12, 15 people grouping into one car, which you are probably aware doesn't allow for much room for a wheelchair to go into. With destination-based systems, these elevators are pre-assigned, which allows for fewer people to go into each one of these cars, allows for more room inside the elevator, allows for more time to get to the elevator in accessibility mode and bring you to your destination and announce that destination prior to your arrival. And once you're in the building, the operation to get back down to go out of the building is virtually the same. So we think that it's intuitive in a lot of ways, and that it makes sense not only from a basic or a normal user standpoint, but it also makes sense on an accessibility standpoint, because the elevator lobby station, which used to be just or still is an up and down button that says nothing about where you're going, now that station is used to provide direction. And it provides audible signals. It provides verbal commands on how to enter and how to go to and find your way to the next available elevator, or the elevator that's ultimately taking you to your destination. So essentially, those are the human differences, the interface difference from conventional systems to these new systems. And we believe that they far exceed the accessibility standards or performance standards from the ADA code that is in place now. So the system benefits, really, is that there are visual and audible instructions that are presently not available on conventional systems. The additional benefits are that there are precise car assignments or elevator assignments given to you prior to entering the elevator that knows your ultimate location where you want to go. There's less crowding in the elevator cabs for the mobility disabled. There's less interaction with elevator fixtures overall because there's no input now. In addition to keying whether you're going in the up and down direction from the hall, on a conventional system, you have to go inside the cab and find your floor button, too. So there's two levels of interface with a conventional system and destination. There is only one. Increased dwell time, or the amount of time that the doors stay open when the elevator system is notified that there's an accessibility requirement. Gives you more time to get there. It tells you where to go. Reduced overall trip time from the time that you walk into that lobby to the time that you arrive at your destination. So, I guess the only thing that we really see at this point, the only constraint to these systems is that it's new. It's a new technology, and it's a different way that you will actually use an elevator or direct an elevator. But we have found through the studies with the American Foundation, with California Council for the Blind, for the Lighthouse, for all of these agencies that represent your community, is that the learning time or the learning curve to use these devices is very small. Once you use them, they're easy to get used to. They are very tactile. They provide keypads in a numeric sense that are similar to a keypad that you find on a telephone, with the nib on the 5 key, with the braille designation next to your main egress, things of that nature. So we are hoping that the first attempt to use these is a learning attempt, and that the learning curve is very short, very small, and that you would find the system to use much easier than conventional systems. So we do believe in the elevator industry that this is a thing of the future. It is coming. The objective is to satisfy that technological demand to make systems and buildings more efficient, but also provide increased accessibility for those who require it. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much. I know there must be, and there have been, questions, and we're going to give you an opportunity to ask questions. Sarah will have a microphone, and she'll bring it to you. Just keep in mind that the access information that I know of very great interest to everyone will be addressed with our following, the speakers who will be following. But to understand the operation of this type of new elevator, if we have any questions, Bernice has asked the opportunity to speak first on a question, and then Sarah can, if you raise your hand, Sarah will bring a microphone to you, and then you can ask your questions to our first two speakers. Bernice,
here's the microphone.
Okay, thank you. Ed, I'm very concerned about the lack of access, as you described it, for a population that is a large number of us attending this convention, and that is a number of people who are visually impaired are also hearing impaired. And the I will describe two elevator scenarios in a moment, but I want to say that when you are in an elevator lobby, the acoustics are poor, the noise level, if there are a lot of people there, is very high, or just the ambient noise of the area. And even that really impedes a person from being able to hear the audible instructions. When you're talking about it's going to tell you which car and tell you how to get there, you still need to have some orientation to the area to know exactly what to do. The last time that I was at the Palmer House Hilton in Chicago, the elevator bank has 12 elevators, 4 on the right side wall, 4 on the left wall, and 4 on the wall in front of you. In the center of the lobby, of that elevator lobby, is a huge glass top table. You press the button, and you may be standing on the right side, and an elevator opens up on the left wall or the back wall, and you make a mad dash, you crash into the table, you get there, and the door just slams in your face. The other elevator situation that I experienced was at the Marriott in Atlanta at the Peachtree Center, where the elevator bank is, you have to walk on one of 4 bridges to an inner cylinder. The bridges are, the walls of the bridges are clear acrylic, so if you're low vision, it's a pretty scary thing because you can see the water below and you can't tell what's what. You get to the inside of the cylinder. It is dark brown and orange. And the first day we were there, there were no signs. The second day, some signs appeared that were not tactile. They were silver ovals with maroon print. And we needed to know that these 3 elevators went to certain floors, the next 3 went to other floors, and the next 3 went to other floors. Those are nightmares, and I don't see how this, what you're describing, is really going to assist in those kinds of situations and with those kinds of disabilities.
Would you like me to respond?
Yes.
It has been my experience as well in a number of facilities that I believe that sometimes the architectural community has intentionally designed obstacle courses from the first entry of that building to the ultimate elevator bank. But I'm not saying that every particular building is going to be a good fit for destination-based systems. There are obvious restrictions in people movement in larger lobbies, for instance, or lobbies that have unusual ways to get to elevator cars. But that would exist, don't you think, in conventional systems as well as destination-based systems. If you're pressing a button to go up, you first have to find that button. And the wayfinding aspects of any conventional system is, for the sight impaired, is to listen for those elevator chimes.
But you didn't hear me. If you're hearing impaired, you may not hear those. And you don't have the visual to seek out any kind of visual thing.
I guess that for both visual as well as hearing impaired individuals, the current, how does the current conventional code satisfy that?
It doesn't.
Okay.
And how many people in here have a mild or moderate hearing loss? Wow.
Okay. I guess, again, there are other hands in the air, but what I try to attempt to answer here is that there are restrictions that I guess under any set of scenarios, we're not going to be able to handle the entire population in the most efficient way. I believe that conventional systems have a current code that expresses how people find their way to elevator banks, and these new systems provide at least an equivalent access to that or an enhanced access by at least describing where you need to go next.
I have to agree with Ed. My own experience is the same thing. I was in Las Vegas last week, and I was staying at the Luxor Hotel. And when I checked in, and that woman handed me a map and took out the magic marker and started sketching me a route, I knew I was in trouble. It can be, and exactly what Ed said, it may be architecturally pleasing yet functionally flawed all at the same time. So, I mean, we all are aware that things aren't necessarily as user-friendly as we would all like them to be, which is part of the reason we're here talking to you people today, to get input on, you know, what we can possibly do to make this easier for everybody.
Do I have the floor, or you?
You have the floor right now. If it's to clarify how this technology works, because I really would like a lot of the access issues or questions, if we could possibly hold those so that you can hear from our speakers about who can give you reports on the access features, the pluses and minuses. But the concept, go ahead, please.
This is Annette from the audience, and I wanted to tag on to Bernice's because she beat me to it, and I wasn't satisfied, and I'm hearing the people around me weren't satisfied with the answer she got. I'm just blind, but I represent people with both vision and hearing loss. I work in that community constantly. That's my daily living. And the part that I wasn't satisfied was, well, we can't, you know, have access for everybody, and it just, well, not knowing how we can provide this access is one thing, but saying we can't is another thing. If you look at the, I know it's a different situation, but to cross the street, if you have no vision or hearing, unless you know about what is technically available and achievable, then you'd say, well, there's no way a deafblind person can cross the street safely, until you know how you can have the vibrotactile, you know, with Braille and raised lettering, you know, access to cross the street and get to where your destination needs to be. One way would be, you talked about wayfinding. That is one of the things. There is a standard, as you know, for the level, you know, from the floor where signage needs to be, Braille tactile. In those standard locations, you could say, just to identify where the elevator doors are, one of six. Then I know, oh, there's five more. Two of six, three of six. So you could have that in raised and Braille, for those that don't read Braille or don't, and then with the information when an elevator has come, which elevator do I go to, wherever your input thing is, to put the information where you have it audibly for people that can hear it, and in a noisy environment, that's one thing. But if I can't hear and can't see, then there needs to be some way to for that information to come up, so that there is a way to go, but we don't want to say, well, we can't please everybody, because that's just not the answer. An example of an audible inside a car in the town I live in, or near, in the Department of Rehab, and this is just for people that are blind. It's just audible. It tells you which direction it's going, up or down. This morning, I wanted to go down to the lobby, and it rang, and I got into the car, and then it took all the stops to go up to the penthouse because I didn't know it was up or down. So for that, you know, it sounds like if you can access the information where it's going, which door you're supposed to go to, then that would be fine. But accessing that information is another thing. Anyway, at the Department of Rehab building, it says up or down when the door is open, so you know to head to the one that you heard saying it's going up. And then it'll say the floors, audibly say the floors at each floor, so you know. But if that could also be accessed in another way, then that would help serve the deafblind community.
Okay, thank you. I think we're starting to get into the access, and perhaps maybe, unless there's some objections, and I want to hear, maybe perhaps we need to have our other panelists talk about the access and...
I have some fact questions first.
Is it not to do with access, Ken?
No. I agree with you. We should do that after we know how the system works.
Okay, then go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, thanks. This is Ken Stewart. And this subject is dear to my heart, partly because the elevator was invented in my hometown, Yonkers, New York. And it was invented by a chap who I played in a pageant once. Elijah G. Otis invented the elevator, and he called it the perpendicular stairway. So how the system works, all that I've read over the last few years about this, I've not heard anything or read anything about what the system is like elsewhere in the building. And perhaps Ed and Nikki can tell us what the controls are like inside the cabin. Is it possible to override the dispatcher? What it's like when you're on the fifth floor and you want to go to the 12th floor, what the call buttons are like. You know, does it increase or decrease your chance of getting an elevator right away? What happens when there's a big meeting on the eighth floor and people are leaving from that big meeting to three different destinations within the building? Thank you.
You know, I guess we kind of left out that whole idea of what happens once you actually get inside the car. Just to reiterate, it's the same idea. You'd walk up to a keypad and you'd say you want to go to whatever floor. But when the door's open and you get inside the car, all of the call buttons are no longer accessible. They're behind a cabinet door. They're not accessible. They are hidden. I'm just saying, when you get into the car, they don't exist. There are no more call buttons inside of the car.
Once you're in the car, you're committed.
You're committed. Absolutely, you are committed.
Except there are the stop or emergency stop.
Exactly. There's still the door open, door close button. There's still the emergency button. There's still the emergency telephone. All of those functions are still the same. The only thing that you will notice that is different is that there aren't any more call buttons because you already told the system where you want to go. Okay? Now, as far as the elevator operation goes, if for some reason the building was to go on fire service, the fire alarm goes off and so forth, everything acts exactly the same way it does today with a conventional system. Once you're inside the car and you're on your trip, there's visual displays that'll say where the car is going, what its next stop is. There's audible, what floor. It'll announce the floor that it's at. As far as operation goes, it is exactly the same way throughout the entire building. You use a keypad in the lobby. You use a keypad on the fifth floor. You use a keypad on the 12th floor. Same concept. You walk up to that keypad and you tell it where you want to go. If you're on the 12th, then you want to go to the 14th, you put in 14. It's exactly the same no matter what floor you're on.
I'd like to add just one thing. In addition, this requirement for raised, print, and braille signs on the door jambs still exist for these elevators. So the hoistway, you still have them. That hasn't changed. Ed, would you like to say anything in response?
You know, I think Nikki answered that one quite well, so I don't have anything to add.
This is Annette. I have a follow-up question for Nikki.
Go ahead.
Nikki, you said about the telephone and those emergency things. On these elevators, or does it depend on the building what they do? If you pick up the telephone, and you don't say anything, will emergency personnel come anyway? My question is, in the building in Oakland that I, on the board, I come to Oakland, it's known that if you pick up the telephone and you don't say anything, emergency personnel come anyway because we have a big population of people that are deaf.
That's exactly how it works. If you either press the alarm button, the system activates the telephone inside the car, and someone will speak to you. You know, people press the button by mistake all the time, so someone will announce to you. It's basically not the old receiver phones that you pick up anymore. They're buttons. Most of the modern elevators today have what we call hands-free phones. You just basically press the button. Either you press the alarm button or you press the button on the phone. Somebody talks to you.
Okay.
Do you have an emergency?
And then
do you
what?
Need help? Help is on the way. So someone will talk to you. And there's lights. There's little lights that flash next to the phone that say help is on the way. So that someone, there's audible and visual and announcement that somebody knows you have a problem.
Okay, Nikki, okay. Let me clarify the question because I hear the people around me also agree you didn't understand. If somebody that is deaf and are deaf and blind, if you activate that, will they come anyway because they will not hear you speaking to them?
Yes. Someone will come. They assume that something, if they don't get any response back, they assume that something's wrong. That's a given.
Also, it not necessarily is the person responding or monitoring physically in that building. It can be in a different location. And that I got from a meeting just recently at the State Fire Marshal's office. So that varies, and it depends on the building and the locality. And that's separate from this new elevator technology, too. Are there any other questions?
Yes.
Not to deal with access, but to deal with the concept of how this elevator operates.
Yes. My name is Glenda, and I'd like to ask if the control thing, are they going to be on the outside of the elevator? And are they like, is there going to be a volume control on it? For like when she said it was busy, you know, and noise and everything.
We're not talking about the telephone.
No, I'm talking about on the outside of the elevator, the keypad part.
Ed or Nikki?
Because what if it's a totally blind person goes into a building they've never been in before, whereabouts would the keypad itself be? I mean, right as you walk through the door, over by the elevators, you know. There are some of us that, when it comes to geography, where what is, we do tend to get lost.
I mean, I guess the question is, where's the location of the buttons? The keypad, and confirming that it is the telephone keypad design.
Well, as for answering where the keypad is, it is. We always mount a keypad where you would normally find your up and down button. That's a given. And in most cases, we'll put extra keypads, one on one side and one on the other side, directly across from wherever that keypad might be, so that there's more options for you to put your call in, as for the question that was earlier about what happens if you have so many people trying to use a keypad. Mm-hmm. Volume, if you do press the accessibility button, there is a set volume based upon industry standards for, you know, requirements and so forth. So that we understand that especially the main lobby is going to be a lot busier than maybe an upper floor. There might be a lot more echo. There tends to be more echo in a lobby, that sort of thing. So we do make sure that everything is at the correct decibel level that it needs to be at.
Okay, I had two other quick questions. Would there also be like a portable little gadget, a handheld thing that blind people could have? Eventually.
Could you please get on a mic?
I'm sorry. You usually have a big mouth. I don't need a microphone. Would there be like a portable...
This is being recorded.
Hey, I know I get a big mouth. I'm proud of it. Anyway, would there be like a portable handheld little gadget eventually made for, you know, like say out-of-towners or whatever, such as we are, and they kind of like a radio type of thing or something to point at the buttons and whatever? Am I making myself kind of sort of...
No, you're not. There's so much... Again, this is evolving so much, and the technology is... Things are coming a lot faster nowadays.
Right.
So all of these ideas and so forth are things that, you know, we want to hear from you, and, mm-hmm. you know, someday next, you know... You never know when you're going to walk by and have a little, like your car alarm or like a house alarm type right. thing that you just press a button and it calls the elevator for you. I mean, it's there's so much okay. that's possible with this type of system. It's quite interesting.
Okay, my one last very quick
like
question. What if the electricity goes off, and for those of us who have claustrophobia and freak out and stuff, is there some way that somebody would know, help? If it goes off, I mean, how are they going to know we're in trouble?
Again, it's exactly the same as if you were using an elevator today. There's usually emergency power in the building, which takes you, you know, definitely
okay.
all the emergency systems work and so forth.
I'm just asking whatever questions.
Hey, hang on a second. Ed would like to add a little something.
Just to expand on the potential of these systems, there is current consideration on interfacing with the new key stations that may be adaptable to some type of ear device. So if there is, you know, hearing impaired or less hearing than normal, I guess, or hard of hearing, I'm not sure what the proper hard hearing, okay, right, that there may be some type of earplug that can adapt to that, similar to like an ATM now, I believe you can do that. But with technology increasing, you're even talking about the potential for wireless technology and having some type of, you know, little Bluetooth thing, you know,
directing you around the lobby way as well. But these are under consideration.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, now, I really...
Hello.
Time's gone. Now, is this a non-access question?
No.
Because if it is access and no one else has anything about the concept, how does it work? I really want our panelists to talk about access who will address a lot of the questions and concerns you have.
Okay, I have a question. Okay, I'm vision impaired, blind, and also hearing impaired. I would just like to know, I'm a kind of a hands-on type of person. Can you tell me where a couple of these elevators so I can get there and just get a little bit of experience on them?
We sure can.
Here in Sacramento or San Francisco?
I don't think there are any installed in Sacramento yet, but there are a number of sites in San Francisco that have these active stations.
And we can
get
a list.
We'll provide you a list of those locations if you
and
like.
We'll
provide it to the rest of the
group.
We'll
get on
well.
The California
Thank
connection.
You.
Sure.
And there's also both companies have brought in some demos. So when we finish, you'll be able to come to the head table and get an idea of the technology and see some of the hardware. It's not exactly what you'll see at a building, but it'll give you a better understanding. So you'll see something in a little later. Okay.
Hi.
Let's move on into the access, because that seems to be the great interest at this time. And I'd like to ask for our first panelist on this subject, Josh Mealy from Smith Kettlewell Eye Institute, who's an associate scientist who's gone out to a few of the locations and seen some of these installation sites. Has comments and observations and recommendations to make. Josh, do you have a microphone, or would you like this one?
Would you mind if I stand where you are?
Absolutely.
Great. Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right. Josh Mealy from the Smith Kettlewell Eye Research Institute in San Francisco. My role here is as a researcher and scientist that specifically studies accessible technology and information systems. And I've been involved in a number of projects. I got into this by accident, and I don't consider myself an expert on destination-based elevators. But I do consider myself an expert on accessible information systems and usability and user interfaces in terms of accessibility. And that is exactly the most significant difference in the way these elevators work. These elevators, they work just like regular elevators. You go into a building. You interact with it through using buttons. The elevator comes. It takes you to your floor. So as far as, like, the physical aspects of the elevator, it looks just like an elevator. You get into it. It goes up and down. It's not anything that bizarre. The difference is the user interface, and that's what I can speak to. And in addition, to being a scientist, I'm also a blind person, so I've had pretty extensive personal experience dealing with orientation mobility issues, as well as studied them as a scientist. So I'm prepared to speak hopefully coherently to that as well. So since it sounds like there's still a fair amount of confusion about how you interact with these destination-based elevators. So as I go through some of what I believe to be the accessibility challenges of destination-based elevators, I'll try to sort of say, okay, this is how you do it with the new elevators, and this is how you would have done it with the old elevators, okay? Just to kind of help solidify the new paradigm of... pardon me, I'm fighting a cold. The new paradigm of these elevators. So... I want to also commend the CCB for and Gene Lozano for recognizing this as an extremely important issue for blind people, blind and visually impaired people. And I also want to recognize that the elevator industry as a whole Pardon me. Maybe that would help. The elevator industry as a whole has been extremely proactive about trying to figure out how blind people and people with physical disabilities are going to interact with. Thank you very much. Are going to interact with these new interfaces. As Ed pointed out, they've been involved with a number of different accessibility consultants, and they've gone above and beyond the standards in a number of ways where standards exist. And they are to be commended for that, I think. But I want to also say that very often when new technologies come along, the standards that exist initially at the beginning of that technology's lifetime, the standards are sketchy at best. And in fact, as we probably all know, standards are not a guarantor of accessibility. Standards are something that someone at City Hall or at ANSI or in ADAG thought would probably do the trick, and so they wrote them down. And once they write them down, because of government and bureaucracy and so on, I'm a big fan, don't get me wrong, but it's tough to change these standards. And so standards themselves do not guarantee accessibility. They only guarantee that there is a set of standards. So what I think is really important for the blind community and for the disabled community in general is to do our best to get these standards as right as we can, as soon as we can, so that this technology is as accessible as it possibly can be. And and I believe that the elevator industry appears prepared to cooperate on that count. I am in no way opposing the forward march of elevator technology, although I did note during Ed's historical perspective that probably the most accessible time for elevators was when there was an actual person in the elevator. And it's been going down, as it were, ever since. That's a joke. The current generation of elevators that we all know and love are reasonably accessible. There are problems, and we all know what they are, and we don't necessarily have solutions to those, and some of those problems persist in the new generation of elevators, and I don't know if we have solutions to them now either. However, I'm going to sort of step through what I see as the challenges now for destination-based elevators. When you first walk into a building, as a blind person, the most common way to figure out where the elevators are is to stop for a minute and listen. That's if you don't have a hearing impairment, okay? A lot of the time, there's sort of environmental cues that come along with elevator banks, the dinging or buzzing or chirping that are the elevators opening and closing and announcing whether they're going up or down with, you know, one-th for up and two-th for down. And the by listening for those cues, those environmental cues, you can actually orient to which direction you should go to find the elevators very often. With the new destination-based elevators, those environmental cues no longer exist. The dinging telling the users whether or not the elevator is going, whether the elevator is going up or down, are no longer present, at least in the installations I've examined. Okay, now the folks from the industry may be able to tell me how things have changed or how things are different in other installations. I've only seen two destination-based elevator installations, one by Otis and one by Schindler, and my most close inspection was about 6 months ago. So it's possible that some of my observations are no longer as relevant as they were, but I believe that they probably still hold some water. So that's the first thing. Finding the elevators is going to be more difficult given that there are no longer these environmental cues. The second task you've got is to find the elevator call button. Now, in a normal conventional elevator system, as we know, usually the call buttons, there's one up and one down if you can go both directions, and the they are located in a small panel, usually in between elevator doors, within inside the elevator bank itself. So when you're in the area with the elevators, on the wall in between elevator doors are going to be the call panels for your conventional elevators. In the destination-based system, what you've got instead of the two buttons, you've got a numerical keypad that you're supposed to enter your destination on. And finding it can be a challenge, because with this new system, they've decided that they don't necessarily have to put it in between the elevator doors. They can actually put it elsewhere. And sometimes, for efficiency purposes, they do in fact put it elsewhere. They it might even be on a pedestal or lectern type thing, quite far away from the elevators themselves. So finding the elevator keypad for these destination-based elevators is going to be a challenge, unless they can standardize where they put the keypad. There might be other possible approaches to finding, to identifying where the keypad is, such as the locator tones that are currently being used on audible pedestrian signals and the like. Again, that doesn't necessarily address people with auditory disabilities, but it it would at least standardize where the keypads are. So this is one of the things that I think needs to be addressed. So the next job, the next accessibility hurdle is calling the elevator itself. In the old system, you would just push the top button for up and the bottom button for down, and you would wait and listen for a ding that represented the elevator that you were going to go to. And any elevator that dinged with the appropriate sound was one of your options. You could get on an elevator that was going up, whether it was the one you had called or the one that was coming right after, or so on. In the destination-based paradigm, you enter your instead of pushing up and down, you enter your floor on the keypad as you're standing waiting for the elevator. So you enter 1-2 for 12, or there's a bless you, yeah. There are a number of accessibility issues in terms of the keypad providing you feedback as you enter the as you enter the numbers. There are some differences in the two installations that I inspected, and I don't want to go into detail about it, but the keys can say their names as you push them, or it can wait until you're done entering the floor before it says which floor you've entered, and so on. Oh, I neglected to mention also there's an accessibility key on the keypad. If you don't push that accessibility key, you won't actually get any auditory feedback from the keypad as you're entering numbers. And the accessibility key is marked with a three-dot symbol, not a braille symbol, but a three-dot symbol where there are two dots horizontally with a single dot below, sort of in a triangle standing on its point formation. This is apparently the ANSI standard for this is the access key. Until I saw it on this installation, I didn't know that. So it's not in common usage yet, but apparently that's the standard. So you push the accessibility key, you enter your floor, it gives you some auditory feedback about what you've entered, and then it tells you, in one way or another, which elevator you should go to. This is the heart of the matter. Everything that I've mentioned so far pales in comparison to the challenge of finding the appropriate elevator car. And to their credit, the folks at Otis and Schindler have really tried to make a system that works. But I think that there's still some room for improvement in both systems. One system uses a system of what I as a nerdy scientist would call directional language, where it actually tells you in words where the appropriate elevator is relative to where you're standing. So it might say, elevator car G behind and to the left, which means that you should turn around, and if you can still remember which way left was, then you go over to that elevator. And that elevator, when it arrives, will also announce elevator G. And it, as they mentioned earlier, it has an increased... when you pushing the access button tells the elevator, hey, maybe hang out for a little while longer than you normally would. Okay, so that's the language, directional language system. Another system that is being used in other installations is what I would call auditory beacons. In other words, rather than telling you where to go, the elevator that arrives makes a unique sound that you would use your hearing to find. So if you've got any kind of unilateral hearing impairment, in other words, if one of your ears is significantly worse at hearing than the other one, your ability to find that elevator is going to be significantly impaired. And in noisy environments, such as the peak periods that were described earlier, where these elevators really shine, hearing that sound and navigating through the crowd to it in a timely manner is going to be a real challenge. The other thing that I want to mention, as was brought up during some of the questions, is that, in fact, some buildings are big enough that they have several elevator banks, not all of which are served, some of which serve some floors and not others. In other words, if you are at the elevator bank that serves floors 60 to 80, you're not going to be able to get to floor 20, and you're then faced with the additional problem of being told how to get to the right elevator bank by the system. And I don't think that that's addressed at all in this in what's being currently done. So that's another problem that needs to be dealt with. Assuming that you assuming that you can find your elevator, once you get to the, you get into your elevator, it tells you when you arrive at the floor that you're going to. The same sorts of things tend to apply in some of the installations. The same access interfaces are used on upper floors. In some of them, they're not. For example, some of the upper floors that I checked out have only a very limited set of accessibility standards. For example, the system that uses the auditory beacon approach to telling you which elevator to get on doesn't use those beacons on upper floors. So it would not work if it were a crowded situation and multiple elevators were opening on an upper floor. It would be a problem. I want to give Jesse an opportunity to talk, and Jean to sort of follow up on these. But I see the future of this technology as I think that probably this technology is inevitable, and we need to basically work with. Work with the standards organizations and the elevator organizations to make sure that the most critical aspects of what we've been discussing are addressed. And I think that the one huge issue of finding the elevator is the one that I think we need to think about the most heavily. My recommended solution to that is basically when someone uses the access key, that the elevator elevator that gets called is an elevator adjacent to the keypad that's being used. It seems to me the most generally friendly solution, so that we don't need to worry about this directional language or the beacons or anything like that. We don't need to worry too much about being able to find the elevator. The elevator system will simply tell you your elevator will arrive to your left or your elevator will arrive to your right. And that's that is, I think, the most appropriate solution. it will impact efficiency. And people will, the elevator companies have already, when I suggested it, there have been objections raised, but I can't imagine that the hit of efficiency is going to be so destructive to the overall system that that it's not a workable solution. As far as specific suggestions, that's the only one that I want to emphasize to you today. I do believe that the approach to take at this point is to develop explicit accessibility standards for destination-based elevator systems, and that they need to be implemented on a state and federal level, and that in fact they need to be vetted with community input once they're developed, and reevaluated in the context of that community input, and that the ultimate guidelines and standards must be evaluated by an independent evaluator, someone who's not tied into the elevator industry or being paid by a specific elevator company. So in order to ensure some kind of fairness and impartiality. So I want to thank you very much for your attention, and after the following people speak, I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Josh. I'd like to ask Jesse if she could please come to this microphone here at the podium and give her observations, comments, and recommendations on behalf of the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco. Jesse.
All right. Can everybody hear me? All right. I'm Jesse Lorenz, the Director of Public Policy at the Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired in San Francisco. Are the largest agency serving blind and visually impaired individuals in Northern California. Our services include rehabilitation, access to information, and advocacy. That's kind of why we're here. Let me give you a little history of our association with this issue. It was brought to my attention by a member of the our local blind community that these new elevators were being installed, these destination-based elevators were being installed at 111 Pine Street. Sounded kind of interesting, so I wanted to check out what these new systems were all about. Went to visit the installation at 111 Pine, and I want to commend the industry because they're definitely working in good faith to make these systems more usable for folks with disabilities. That said, there's still a lot of work that ought to be done in order to ensure that people can access them most efficiently. The Lighthouse's concern is not that the technology is bad. We love technology and we want to see things move forward. Is that we don't want to see access to the built environment diminished for folks who are blind or visually impaired. One of the large issues, like Josh stated, is once you push the keypad to say, you know, you want to go to floor 12, for example, finding the car to take you to floor 12. I'm going to go back to a little bit of the history because I think it's important that you understand what's happening on a local level and why we think this is so important. The Department of Building Inspection has granted waivers because right now there is not California Building Code Title 24, which currently regulates standard elevators. There's no California Title 24 code that talks about destination-based oriented systems. So our Department of Building Inspection in San Francisco has to actually grant an exception for the installation of destination-oriented elevator systems. And they had just kind of been doing that. And we have stood up and said, you know, we're really concerned. There are three different companies that have been trying to install these in San Francisco, and the access features between each company vary. Josh talked a little bit about the directionality, the types of directions that the systems give. There's no consistency because there aren't standards. You may have a car say go to car A or car Alpha, car B, two cars to your left, car Bravo. There's no consistency, and that's a really that's a big concern for us. I think that this meeting that we're having here today is a wonderful opportunity for us to really talk with the elevator industry and to begin the dialogue about developing standards for destination-oriented systems. One of the recommendations the Lighthouse supports is having the car adjacent to the keypad come when one presses this access key. That eliminates some of the guesswork in having to, you know, if you're in a big lobby and there are eight elevators, you manage to find your way to the keypad and press the button, the access button, and then it tells you car G behind you and to the left. If it's a crowd, you know, I'm always afraid of taking out old ladies and children because I've... all too regularly, actually. I think it affords much better access and also it keeps the old ladies and children safer if I am just directed to the car adjacent to the keypad. We're going to continue to monitor this issue. We have asked the Department of Building Inspection to cease installation of destination-based elevators until they can go through their administrative bulletin process. The Department of Building Inspection has not listened quite as readily as we'd like them to have listened. We have filed a complaint with the Mayor's Office on Disability, which is still in its... the city has a grievance procedure, and the administrative process allows them 30 days to provide us a response in writing. We are supposed to have a response by the 15th of April. We will continue to pursue this issue. We've also been talking to some of you remember our friends Lainey Feingold and Linda Dardarian from the Accessible Pedestrian Signals Structured Negotiations. We're also chatting with them. We want to see technology move forward, but we want to see consistent standards developed that don't limit the limit access to the built environment for people who are blind and visually impaired. I think that's all that I am going to say. I really want this to be a dialogue.
That's
okay.
Well, I have a question. Just
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jesse. And we'll have questions in a few minutes and also give the elevator industry an opportunity to make any comments since it was about anything that has been addressed. And I, on my trip to Washington, D.C. last week, I went to an installation site of one of the destination-based elevators, the manufacturer Schindler, at JW Marriott Hotel at 1331 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest. So if anyone is going there, I believe the installation is fairly new, probably no more than 3 or 4 weeks. It appears that it is being fine-tuned, adjustments are being made. But I thought, at least in my experience, and I found that it's a multi-story building, more than 15 stories. I don't know the total number, but at least I know definitely 15. In the lobby, I found that there were two keypads located between the elevator car doors. It was similar to a telephone keypad. The buttons, I had nothing to measure, but I had to guess that they were square buttons, very well raised, very distinct. They were angled at a 45-degree angle.
good separation between the buttons, so you could easily distinguish the individual buttons. And it was easy to operate because of the fact that the buttons were at an angle. Where if they had been mounted at a vertical, like the existing call buttons, and you're trying to figure out bending your finger, it would become a problem because this is at a level for wheelchair access in this installation site. The buttons had recessed numerals embedded on each button, in addition to a little raised dot two dots for the number 5 button. I would have preferred meeting code if that the recessed numerals were all raised, and if there had been a braille accompanying, there seemed to have been adequate space there. And this is just a tooling thing there. The access button, as Josh referred to, was beneath it, and it had the little triangle with the 3 raised dots. There is a philosophical issue within the blind community whether you want to have to do perform additional step to push the button for access features to be activated, or to have them all on automatically. And I can understand that, particularly for accessible pedestrian signals. My experience at this hotel, I really was happy to see the access button was available. My wife was accompanying me. We were there, and there was about 20 individuals in that lobby. There were 2 keypads. My wife pushed the access button on the other keypad, and I did too. What occurred was that we got an announcement as to the floor from the keypad, what floor we had requested. So that was good, so I knew that it was registered. This is after pushing the access key. Then the 2 elevators arrived almost simultaneously, and I got then 2 auditory announcements from different parts there, overlapping one another, one saying, gave the directional information to the right, elevator E. These are not exact things, but it just gave you directional, as Josh said, gave directional information where to go and the letter for that particular elevator. Okay, and it also had a little chime, ding, ding, and then gave the elevator, and then ding, ding. Well, these were overlapping. I couldn't tell which direction. So that is a real plus for the access key, so that, and we did experiment where my wife did not push it, the access key, she pressed the other buttons to the floor she wanted to go, I pushed the other one, I heard it, it was a lot easier for me to locate it. So I really see the benefit. Yes, and that is something that within the blind community, I think we have to look at this elevator and have a philosophical discussion on this, and then bring a recommendation before the elevator industry on this one. Locating the car call buttons or the keypad, it's the same thing as we have the problem, is trying to find it. You know, ideally, there should be maybe a little locator tone that gives a little beeping sound. Doesn't help the hard of hearing, but at least where you're not having to touch every wall between each elevator and find sometimes the cigarette ashtray. They're still out there.
Totally true.
And they're not supposed to be used, but sometimes you find they're filled. That's a different thing. The thing was, I also found that when I got into the elevator and there was some other people who got aboard and they were assigned to that same elevator, we went to the floor and arrived. There was no announcement, ding, or anything that told you which floor you arrived. Now, maybe that something wasn't working, but there was a visual sign, the indicator that told you in the car that you had arrived which floor. If I didn't ask somebody or lean out on the hoistway to feel the tactile sign, I wouldn't know what floor it was. And that was going up and down. Except coming down one time, there was an auditory announcement said, you arrived zero floor, which was the lobby. And that's the only time. There was other times I'd gone there. I don't know. So maybe there was a malfunction there. But it was exciting. I see some things that could be adjustments. Going back to the keypad, I mentioned about the locator town. And I could also see... Glenda was asking about it, and that's something where you could see about the infrared talking signs, for instance, technology being incorporated in there. So those who would like to use that technology to locate the elevator lobbies, they could locate it and then also locate the car control, the call buttons. But not everyone has those or prefers carrying us, and I'm not getting into a discussion. It's not empty, but it is some technology that would help in that way that does exist. It's been around for more than 20 years, and I can see various fields of technology coming together. I definitely could not see having a freestanding call button in the lobby there, and you're trying to get around people to get to that and locating it would be a real problem. But some of the problems that we've talked about, you know, like, and I don't disagree about, you know, where there's certain elevators designated to go to certain floors, and then the other side of the building is another bank of elevators. That's a problem that exists now. It exists with this other technology, and that's where there has to be some signage to provide, and that might be tactile signage. So, those is just a quick overview of my comments, my experience there. It's the way of the future. It's exciting. We need to all work together. And yes, standardization, predictability is needed. Just like everyone has said, we want standardization so wherever we go in this country that we can it operates the same way. I just want, before the audience asks any questions, if anyone from Nikki or Ed want to make any comments in response to anything that we may have said from the access perspective, and either one of you?
Actually, I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce George Kappenhagen. He was instrumental in working with ANSI on ADA code, and I'd like to give him the opportunity to explain to you what exactly is written in the ANSI code for destination-based systems.
Yes. What I would like to explain to everybody at this meeting is talking about introductions of destination-oriented elevators in California. Very rightly so. And discussion is that, you know, this is a new concept. I have been on the accessible route for the Federal Access Board for the new ADAG. I've been a member of the A117 committee for the last three cycles. I'm the alternate for Mr. Brian Black, who was unable to attend this meeting so far, and is the member representing the elevator industry. Companies did not, as it appears here, just come out and invent this. Back in 1991, there were federal accessibility guidelines. There were some destination-oriented elevator systems back at that time. Mr. Black has written a letter that could be put into Braille on what happened on the industry positions or passed out to this group, and I hope that happens. I was called to speak only after I heard that Brian wasn't able to make this meeting. But as early as 1996, the Federal Access Board ruled that destination elevators already installed in buildings complied with the applicable requirements of the existing 1991 ADA accessibility guidelines, but that the unique features of destination systems, and I won't go through them all, confuse some trying to apply the accessibility requirements written for the traditional elevators. So what happened in development of the 1998 code, which was already in the code development cycle for 1998, the A117 code developed these requirements for destination elevators and described them very carefully. There were discussions with many. There are many of the national groups involved in the discussions. And also there were three California groups, Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund, happened to be Marilyn Golden, she's still on the committee, World Institute on Disability, Mr. Hale Zukas, fine gentleman with multiple disabilities, was also on the committee. We had John Paul Scott from the mayor's office of San Francisco. So three members out of this perhaps 35-member committee were from California, and they did present input, and the code rules were developed. And a number of changes made as this developed. And I don't want to go through them all because we're probably getting later in the morning here. But a number of things happened. And one of the things that happened during the discussions, and we also had presentations of some of the visitations of some of the early installations, were the lobby signals. And as you know, there's a function button for a person with various disabilities they can push. And there was also an old S button in conventional elevators that the industry dropped as too hard to get to. In other words, you had to get in the car, was crowded, you had to get to the S button. So in the code for quite some time now, since 1998, car passing tones are required and allowed up to 200 feet per minute. Above 200 feet per minute, all elevators have to announce the destination floor. In the latest A117-2003 code, they have to announce it before the doors open so that lobby noise does not bother the people inside the car and they can hear. In regard to the function button, it was also made clearly known to the elevator industry during these discussions at the A117 committee that if all the time you use destination elevators, regardless of who entered the button, you got a tremendous amount of lobby noise. And it was very hard for somebody that really needed to find it, especially in the morning rush hour, when the building was emptying around noontime, actually hear the signals that were needed. So in discussion with groups representing disabilities on the committee, the A117 committee asked and agreed, and we agreed with them, that the function button would be set so that those who needed the function button, when they pushed it, would get a signal. They would be able to hear it because there wouldn't be a clutter of signals from everybody to push the keypad, and they could be more readily directed to the elevator they needed to go to. That is why the function button is there. Would we like to? Could we leave it on all the time? Sure. But it would be a great disservice to anybody that's blind or visually impaired or has hearing loss if we tried to do all these things all the time in the system. We've also, moving on from the 1998 code, refined many things in the 2003 code. And I mentioned the one, I said later, we made the floor announcement inside the car occur before the doors open. That occurred for the 2003. Now, California hasn't picked up a lot of things in the national code. And the industry has been submitting proposals recently in the last two cycles to the Office of the State Architect when it comes out for comment. We suggested various pieces of the 1998 A117 code, the 2003 code, and not only for destination elevators, for all elevators. There's things like scan features for somebody in a wheelchair that does enter a conventional elevator, and there's just too many buttons to put all in one panel. They get a scan button that they can use. It has to be there. So many of the things that you're fighting with and you see are already in the national code. And, you know, I really would encourage that if this group looks at something, they don't just look at destination elevators. They look at everything that has happened nationally and some of the groups that have been involved. The national code also has very clear requirements for audible tones, 3,000 cycles per second, or hertz, however you're calling it, is the maximum. Audible announcements are 300 cycles per second to 3,000, even for the majority of the voice, realizing that some tones in your voice may exceed that. That makes it easier to hear. So these efforts are trying to make things easy to hear. In the latest code change cycle, there is material that was submitted from the California Council of the Blind and other groups on contrast ratios. And there's going to be a new proposal being accepted to the national code. It improves upon the ADA 70% contrast ratio figure because it says that if you have a low reflectance value, it can't be less than 45. So that eliminates the problems in certain combinations where you can get something that meets that 70% in the ADAG advisory, but you can't really see it. That's going to be fixed. And the elevator industry has constantly worked and supported those kind of things. Also, the Lighthouse in San Francisco, I'd like to compliment them. They have provided handouts that I've used nationally and converted everything to Braille. It's sort of an industry generic handout that I had. It was too late for me to attempt to bring those here. Today, I have noticed that during the same last eight or nine periods, Schindler has done the same. The Lighthouse in San Francisco has printed all of their material in Braille. I'm not sure about some of the other companies because even though I'm retired, I formerly worked with Schindler, and I have a little more knowledge of what Schindler is doing. So I think that, you know, part of what we've done already exists, and sound levels and everything, and, you know, things like were mentioned that what do we do, how do we help those that are both blind and hearing impaired. We attack them in pieces in the national code. And I'd like to see California do the same thing. So I think there's a lot there that needs to be done. But I just wanted to assure you that both the Federal Access Board, the full A117 committee, have been working with the elevator industry. We put something down there. And I can see in the discussion this morning, there's some discussion of things that have already been improved that are problems in California. And that needs to be considered. Some of the comments indicate that the industry has tried to help, very open. We've tried to be that way in the national committees, and we tried to be that way here. And I really believe that you should understand that, lacking anything else, what the elevator industry is trying to build to is the national A117 code, which goes in a little more detail than ADAG, but does not conflict with it. And the new ADAG also picks up the destination elevators. Again, not completely. That's why A117.1 has gone a little further. And some of the things that California wants, there was a big comment on lack of signage to elevators. Now, the industry proposed to even the A117 committee the need for signage in corridors in Braille on how to get to the various elevator banks. Actually, we were denied because that's not the purvey of the elevator section in the national code. It's the purvey of the buildings. And it was felt that at that committee, that should be something the architects and the building owners have responsibility for, that they should provide signs in Braille and tactile and visible that direct people to find the elevator bank in the first place so you know where you're going. I just wanted to bring some of that background out without going through the national rules bit by bit to show you how they address a lot of the questions that you have. I've answered a few of them. And I thank you for giving me a short chance to speak on behalf of NEA.
I want to thank you very much, George, for that presentation there. Yes, and I just want to just add, I want to confirm that having been on the ANSI A117 committee, the 92 edition, that it is sometimes, like stated, where one industry brings up an item that sometimes it's felt that it's in the another professions. So sometimes it's hair splitting, but it does happen. I know that just recently I'm on the Division of State Architects Advisory Committee, and Richard Scaff, who was unable to come, brought up this and said that we needed to start looking at it. So there's going to be some movement on that, and this is the Council, the American Council of the Blind, our parent organization, as well as the California Council of the Blind, do want to work with the elevator industry as a whole to come up with California specifications as well as any refinements to the national requirements. So we do want to work with you. Now, there are questions, and is Sarah still with us? Is Sarah here? Okay. So people could raise their hands, and then the volunteer can get to you, and we want to get it recorded. And then if you could direct it to who you would like a response, and then we'll see if there's anyone else who wants to respond from the panel. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Glenda, and I have two questions. One, would those keypads be just on the bottom floor or on every floor? Say, for instance, somebody is up on the 15th floor,
they're on every floor,
and there's no keypad on the 15th. Was it going to go straight down to zero?
They're on all floors. They're on all floors.
They will be on all floors.
They are. They are on all floors.
Okay. My other question is: Are there any of them that are going to be in San Diego, California?
Actually, yes. There's one being installed in San Diego right now.
Where?
It's still in its process, so it's not. I don't believe it's turned on yet.
Where at?
Oh, God, I'm trying to remember. I'm going to have to get that for you. I can't remember the name of the building.
All righty.
Well, we'll get you a list of all the buildings, of all the installations
from
that we know
of. All companies, we'll get that.
So that if you're anywhere, you know, if you happen to be in the area of any of these buildings, you get the opportunity to go inside.
Definitely. I would definitely like to have one. Thank
you. Next questioner.
My name's David. Maybe this can go to Josh. This is a question more of orientation. As you leave the cab of the elevator, will there be some kind of an announcement when you leave that there are a series of rooms, say 1 to 10 on your left and 20 to 35 on your right, so that when the person leaves, they have some sense of which direction to take in order to complete their destination.
Hi, this is Josh. No, I'm sure that they aren't doing that. I think that probably the same reasoning that Gene and George just referenced would apply, that that the elevators, it's the elevator's job to get you from one floor to another, and once it's done its job, you're on your own, buddy. So, yeah, no, they're not doing that, and I know of no plans to do that.
Can I comment on that?
Yes, please, Ed. Do you have a mic?
That would be a building requirement. It's an architectural requirement, not an elevator requirement.
Wayfinding is something that is not really clearly stated in the ADA, but it is out of the scope of what elevators are, the function of the elevators. It's something that needs to be addressed to the codes, California as well as federal, but it's not through the elevator process. It is very important, what you were asking about. Any other questions?
This is Annette. I wanted to first thank all the panelists here. It was interesting hearing from the elevator industry and from both elevator companies, and I especially liked the presentations from Jesse and Josh. And for Jesse and Josh, as you're, I agree that we need to, you know, get into wording of the legislation. It's up to us to make sure, you know, if we want something, we need to be active and be specific. My specific point is I liked the ideas, I think it was from both Jesse and Josh, if there was not too many choices of where your car will be coming. And so for that, to address the needs of people with both vision and hearing loss, vibrotactile, as are in the APSs, not on that same keypad, because everybody's going to be wanting that keypad. So if there were a standard that almost connected to that grid of the keypad, an extension of it, had a left-right arrow, and you only... maybe it's one car, and that's good, but it be a raised arrow that vibrated, as does the accessible pedestrian signals. So when your car is coming, you can have your hands on that arrow, and you're not obstructing that keypad for anybody else to use, but then that will vibrate when your car is arriving. That would solve one of the things.
Would somebody from the elevator industry like to first, I guess, respond to the first thing, having the elevator immediately adjacent to the call, the keypad, be the one that responds, and if there could be a separate device that would be in that close vicinity that would have a vibrotactile arrow in there to assist somebody who's totally deaf and blind, so they'd have that to provide the information, the direction of the arrow, whether it's to the left, the elevator to the left or the right of where they're standing. Anyone from the elevator industry would like to respond?
Yeah, actually, I'd like to comment.
Go ahead.
On the adjacent car issue, it's definitely not something that we haven't thought about before. Part of the reasoning behind not doing that is somewhat practical. If you happen to confine it to one car being able to take those calls, if for some reason that one car happens to be down for some reason for maintenance, then that functionality goes away. Or the fact that if that one car is the only car available to take those types of calls, your wait times could be increased significantly if there happens to be, you know, multiple calls going on at the same time. Things like that. I mean, it isn't that we haven't thought about that. It's just the whole idea was to make sure that if you've got a bank of eight elevators, we want to make sure that you have the opportunity to get the same level of service as everyone else in the building to get you up to your floor faster. And if we start taking away the ability to use those other cars, I mean, it's a performance-based convenience. I mean, it's something we can seriously consider, but there
are impacts to doing it that way. As far as the vibrating tactile, again, we're looking for ideas of this type to help us in the technology side. Any information on these type of things, I mean, we're going to send you information. Anything that you can send to us is also very useful for these types of technologies that most of us don't aren't even aware exist.
We'll get you that information. Ed and George, do you, either one would like to make any further response in addition to Nikki's? That's sufficient? Jesse reminded me, and Ken might have some additional information, that the American Council of the Blind, the American Council of the Blind passed a resolution at its national convention last year on this subject matter. I don't remember all the details of the resolution, but there was one thing that was indicated, and that was a display for refreshable Braille. So for those who are tactile users who cannot use auditory information or visual would have that information. I was wondering if the industry has looked into this, the use of a display with refreshable Braille, and it has any comments on this that they can at this time give?
Actually, no. I mean, again, this is type of technology that I think I don't want to speak out of line for all my the people who are here with me, but that we have never actually heard of or experienced. So any way that you can help us learn more about helping you is very welcome information.
Okay. Jesse and Josh, is that something that both of your organizations can help them give some information about the refreshable Braille, do you think?
I just have a comment about it.
Go ahead.
And that is that the American Council of the Blind's resolution says not to said not to support the installation of destination-oriented systems unless there was a refreshable Braille option. And realistically, I think that we have to be honest with ourselves that we're probably not going to get that as an option with destination-based elevators. Though it is an intriguing thing to consider that that would certainly bring down the price of refreshable Braille displays.
Yes, it doesn't have to be a big display.
Yeah, and I think I think that the ACB is looking at that resolution and whether or not it's actually realistic, and they'll be looking at that at the 2008 convention. So it's a good thing that we're having these types of conversations.
Yes. Okay.
Okay, can I just... George here has one comment he'd like to make.
Sure.
George Kappenhagen, representing NEI. A couple further points on getting from the keypad to the car. The general concept, at least as we thought about it in the ADAG groups and national committee groups, is that once you got the designation of the car from the keypad, that the tones or audible announcements would direct you immediately thereafter to the car that you wanted to use. And then we put, in addition to the floor designation on the jam, we put the car designation on the jam, which has the car letter and the Braille underneath that, so that you have both jams with the car, and if you're directed to that before the car comes, you also have just pure tactile ability to discern that you actually got to the right car. Now, we felt there were some problems in doing that in the code in some detail, because it wasn't until 2003 that we required all of the floor numbers to be numeric. And in the national 2003 code, there's a requirement, and very much supported by those that are vision impaired or blind, that we use numbers throughout for the floor numbers and use letters throughout for the cars, or at least start the car designation with an A or a B and go on. And then I'd like to also comment on a further consideration of why adjacent elevators might not have been chosen. It hasn't come up in the discussion here, but it did come up at various committee meetings, and that's why it isn't specified in the National Code. The other consideration was that while generally if the function button was pressed, it was expected that elevator manufacturers would do the lobby announcements, but also do various other things like pick cars that were slightly less loaded, increase the time between keystrokes if you're punching one to two, might give another invisible second or two in timing to get to the cars. And most manufacturers do add these nuances on that aren't required by the code. But if you had four cars, for instance, and one car was assigned four calls, a couple others were assigned three calls already, and the other car only had two calls, normally the system would put that person in the car with two calls. And then that car would have three calls because it would be the least loaded car, and then that car would get no more calls of non-function pushes and go up. But what would happen if it was an adjacent car, which might be the one that already had four calls, that would now get five calls. And it would get the people because the system doesn't know when these buttons are going to be pushed. So this subjects the rider to five stops versus the three stops they would have had. And if they happen to be the last one, that extends their time even more. So that's another nuance as to why this sounds good in all cases, but you know there are the out of order, actually slowing down the system. There are these other things, and if there's a way, whether it be these vibrating braille, following the signals to get to the car before it arrives, with confirmation by the on the jams, it is right. Something needs to be done to be sure that people that need to find a car find it, because the elevator industry wants people to find their car. We like people who use elevators.
Sure. Bernice will ask a question, then I'll let you. Then I'll have you. Bernice has something to say, and Josh does.
Okay. George, I wanted to know if there are currently any blind or people with vision loss on the A117 committee? Is she still?
Pat Beattie's on there for the American Council of the Blind.
Okay. Okay. Because the three people you mentioned from California were not.
Okay. Josh. I'm sorry.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think that. It's important to remember that standards are developed generally by people that have familiarity with the issues and often have sort of an involvement in the industries that they're developing standards for, so they understand how it impacts the users and the manufacturers, et cetera. The kinds of guidelines and standards that I think will lead to the best accessibility. In this case, of course, I'm a scientist. I think that these are all empirical questions. I think if we think that it's going to impact efficiency so badly that it's an unworkable solution, that's an empirical question. We should set up a system that has it, that implements the solution, and a system that doesn't implement that solution, and it's a scientific question. We see how bad it is or how good it is. We ask the people how it was to use the system in both conditions, and we do an evaluation based on information, not an evaluation based on sort of theoretical ideas about what might or might not happen. We need to
You know, I see this as an opportunity to learn, but I don't think that it's I don't think that thought experiments are going to get us to the answers. I think that we need to actually do the research to find out what's going to work and what's going to negatively impact the systems.
Thank you, Josh. Are there any other questions?
This is Annette Carter. To follow up.
Wait, excuse me, Annette. Let's first see if there's anyone who's not asked a question already first, and then we'll come back to yourself and others. Anyway, if you have not already asked a question, please raise your hand so the volunteer can get to you.
Well, I was given the microphone, although I have asked a question already. Anybody else need it? Okay.
We lost our volunteer?
No, I don't know about that, but here I am. Sheila Gunn Krishman, I have a quick question and some comments. My quick question is, if you're going to floor 1 through 9, would that be 0, 1, 0, 2, etc.?
No.
So you just type 1?
You would type either 1 or you could press 0, 1.
Okay.
There's a time. So when you press the 1, the system will hesitate for a second to make sure that you're not putting in a second digit, and then it would put it into the first floor.
Okay. One of my biggest concerns about having to push the access button is not that I have to do another keystroke. I teach people computers for a living. I can do keystrokes pretty fast. But my concern is that someone needing access will not know they must press the access button. And so it's all well and good to say, gee, if you press the access button, you have all this functionality, but I don't see it happening in practicality and in logistics. There are a lot of people who don't claim a disability and who wouldn't think to say, I need access, but as we know, the elderly population is increasing. Hearing loss and blindness are becoming more of a common thing than they used to be 20 years ago. So I think we need to think about that. Another comment that I have is, I would like, if I were on a floor, to hear when other elevators are going to different floors, because I might be on floor 12 meeting a friend coming from floor 14. And the sense that I'm getting from a lot of comments and a lot of murmuring around me is that we need to have flexibility. For example, I agree with the locator tones. They could be ambience-based. Refreshable braille display may not be practical. How about something like a refreshable raised print display? I have no idea how to do this, guys, but I think it's possible. But I also want you guys to think about logistically. You are totally blind. You are at an airport. You are in a hurry, and you don't want to mess with anything. And then you hear this. You hear three beeps from three different locations because two guys in wheelchairs that you didn't know about press the access button, too. And you are standing there going, guys, which way do I go? And so we need to think about it may not have to be the adjacent car, but I really think that should be considered. And if the issue is about calls and time traveled, then if your dispatcher dispatched another call to that car, he can move that call from that car. I say he. I know it's an it, but anyway. I'm sorry I talked so long. I tried to talk fast. That's all I got.
Okay. Anyone want to respond to that, please?
I'm not sure if you asked a question in the beginning of that. Was there a question about okay, and then there was an accessible. Why do you have to push, or where, how do you know you have to push the accessible button? I guess that's a learning experience. Number one is that if you're encountering a destination keypad, all you have to do is encounter that one time to know that there's an accessible button in that device. So I believe it's partly educational, but there's also been recommendations to have printed or tactile braille instructions adjacent to that device that would tell you how to use it. So these were some of the suggestions that we had taken.
I agree with that.
I think it's to the right of us.
Because people are not going to know. I'm talking about someone who's never encountered a destination elevator, doesn't even know there is one, you
Well, the whole population is going to be facing this with or without a disability. It's going to be education, and I don't know how everyone in the country is going to be educated. I think it's going to be through some trial and error, but it is, to even operate it, everyone is going to be facing that learning curve.
And I also would like to point out that we've just spent a couple of hours talking about it, and I bet some of you are still unclear on how it works. And if you think you're going to communicate how it works in a succinct Braille sign, I think you're dreaming.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just add a couple things. The reality of that whole how to use the system thing, it doesn't matter who you are. When people walk into that building for the first time, especially in a hotel, there is that confusion that comes along with a first-time user. We do some things with the building owners and the tenants and so forth to help them. We do some things as far as visitor access when a visitor comes into the building as to help them understand how to use the system. And we are completely open to helping create some sort of education documentation or some sort of presentation or some sort of training for the visually impaired community. I mean, we do not have a problem with that. We do it for all other aspects. We do it for architects. We do it for consultants. We do it for anyone. We're perfectly open to creating something like that to help educate people on destination systems and how to use them.
Thank you very much. We'll take you up on that, Nikki. Okay, someone who has not asked a question already.
Hi, my name is Lisa. I had a possible suggestion about the access thing, making it, since a lot of people wouldn't recognize the triangle, maybe like in Braille, right next to it, you could have the triangle on the button, but you could also have in Braille either access or help, you know, and maybe some people who wouldn't think about, oh, access, well, what is that? You know, maybe they would hit the help.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's definitely something we can consider.
You know, some sort of Braille next to it. Because
some sort of better instructions. Something simple so it's not something that takes you a lot of time to figure out either.
Or a lot of space.
Exactly.
Next question. Rachel?
Yep, down in front. We got one more.
Hi, this is Roger Peterson. I haven't been here since the beginning, so I hope this hasn't been covered. But I just wanted to mention, I hope maybe Josh and I can talk about this, but I'd like to mention it to the elevator industry people. It's what I call the psychoacoustics of orientation, of auditory localization. For some reason, all kinds of elevators and various things that want to beep at me, use beeps. And a beep, a pure tone, is the worst possible thing to localize. A few years ago, there was a company that was trying to make audible fire alarms, escape, you know, exit indicators, and they found that white noise, that something based on white noise was much more accurately localizable. And also you know, low vision people talk about glare. A lot of lobbies, the live acoustics in a lobby is like auditory glare. And, you know, with the pure tones in the elevators and maybe not coming from the location of the car and the echo in the lobby, I defy you to localize a tone and walk toward it.
Josh, why don't you respond? This has been brought up earlier, but go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, you're right about localizability, and clicks are really good. Clicks are another very broadband noise, and also the onset of a sound is really critical to being able to localize it. So you're right, and again, it's sort of as I understand it in my incomplete sort of lack of policy approach, I see it as sort of where the rubber meets the road, a difference between what's real and what's in the standards.
Thank you. Next question.
Anybody else?
Can it be somebody who already asked a question?
Let's first see if there's somebody that has not had.
He was the only one raising his hand, so go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, this is a follow-up that really goes back to the original how the system works thing that maybe Nikki and Ed can help me and others with. For the general public, at 5 of 9 in the morning, like Jane was describing earlier, a whole crowd's coming in and there's one keypad. How each person gets a visual indication of the car letter, I take it. What's the interval? It's there. It's presented to that person by like a couple seconds, and then the next person gets their letter presented to them.
Exactly. It's a couple of seconds.
Each elevator has that letter identification constant.
Yes.
So they can always know, I got to find G or yes. F or C. So somebody comes into the building without going to the keypad, and they see somebody, oh, she works on my floor. They head for that car. There's no way of confirming that car is going to floor 6, 11, and 17, correct? There's no visual information.
Not outside the car.
Not at all.
When the car arrives, there is.
Wouldn't that be a possible addition, that the visual indication of each car at the hoistway or nearby the entrance could indicate what's already been assigned to this floor, that this particular cabin, that would increase the efficiency, seems to me. So some people would come in and see immediately, oh, that's going 11. I'm going to head right there. I don't need the keypad.
See, there's two ways of looking at that. Yes, it makes it easier for you to figure out, without putting your call in, which car to go into. But that, again, defeats the entire purpose of putting your call in to begin with.
How so?
The system needs to know how many people want to go to that floor. It's not just that car is going to that floor.
If the car is half full and two more people are coming in to that same floor, it's very efficient.
Well, we
from the entrance into that cabin.
We adjust for that. We know. We call it piggybacking. Yeah. Okay. We know that not everybody's going to put their call in the system. We get that. But the problem that happens is if it's, and I hate to say too easy, but if it's too easy for people that come in the main lobby in the morning to not input their call, then the system is going to have problems because you do put your call in. You may not have enough space inside that car when it gets there. So then the person who did it the correct way and put their call in, are the one that's suffering for someone who just wants to hop in.
You.
So there's just really two ways of looking
at it. It's a trade-off.
It's a trade-off.
I appreciate that. Thank you. So the other part of my question, the interval, the duration of the information presentation depends on how soon the next person hits the keypad?
It's an adjustable thing, but usually it's a matter of a couple of seconds. It's completely adjustable. And again, that's why we talk about, yes, there should always be keypads located inside each elevator lobby. Outside keypads, it keeps people from bunching up in that area and kind of it makes the flow of traffic a lot smoother if everybody isn't fighting to use the same keypad.
Yeah, if they know exactly where to look for their visual information and it stays long enough for them to absorb it.
There might be a situation like in a hotel where you know that the average user hasn't used it before, where you may want the timing to be a little bit different than in an office building where everybody uses it all the time and they don't want to wait. You know, it's always a hurry-up thing for most people nowadays.
Yeah. Thank you.
Annette, there was Annette Carter had asked, and I stopped her, and so if she's still here, she would be the next person because everyone else has asked questions. And then Annette?
I just wanted people to think about cognitive disabilities. Not everybody thinks at the speed of light.
Oh, we understand that.
Okay, Annette.
Thank you. And I have to think if I remember. Okay, the answer to the vibrotactile, the vibrating arrow, to if it were put in the standards that it would be an adjacent car that would come. So the answer to that, of course, would be that it would slow down this. It could slow down the system if everybody's wanting to use that car. And that's not the point of the destination-based elevator. And this is similar to the roundabouts in traffic, the circles replacing the standard intersection. They're designed to keep the traffic flowing. And these destination-based elevators are designed to be efficient and keep the people moving and be green. There's many purposes for this design of the elevators. But I think if you ask people, you need to put in your evaluation there that most people that are wanting it to be next to it don't mind the extra weight because they're requiring access is much higher than the minute that they have to wait longer. So the access would trump that. So if you surveyed a bunch of people and asked them which they would prefer, it would be that. Same as a roundabout. I prefer to cross the street and not die as opposed to anything other. So I think the wait time won't matter to the people that want it in that location. They will wait as long as they know it's an elevator going to where they want it to go. So maybe that one will go to all the floors in case there's another bank that only goes to some floors.
Thank you. Josh, do you turn? Yeah, and then Ed there, and then I take about one more question because the industry has some demos, so you have an opportunity because I know a lot of you are ready to go to lunch, and we got some demos which will mean a lot more to you, and we can get questions. If I receive the questions, we can then have them sent to the industry and have them respond and get it out to you. I think Josh wanted to make a comment first.
Very, very quickly. I just want to point out that the concept of having the adjacent elevator come, it doesn't have to happen. These elevators are computer controlled. The computers can be programmed any way that the standards and guidelines decide that they should be programmed. And one possibility is that that you can actually specify that you want the adjacent elevator, maybe by holding down the access button for 3 seconds or something like that. So somebody who wants access but not necessarily the adjacent elevator could that's a possibility as well, and it just depends on the user interface and, again, education of the user population about how to do it.
Ed,
we have
did you want to respond
question?
To this one? Or
yep.
Nikki?
May I just try to make some statements? I wanted to also answer some of the questions that came up earlier. My name is George Von Klan. I'm an elevator consultant, and I've actually specified the systems in the majority of the buildings that have destination in California. Been working on this concept for about 15 years. Worked on it first at the headquarters of Otis Elevator Company in the mid-1990s, and was very interested in particular in a lot of the questions from the group today, from the audience, and also from Gene and Bernice, Josh and Jesse. And in the case of Josh and Jesse, I think I'd love to follow up with you. I work in San Francisco and talk with you about what we're doing now with destination elevators and what's happening with the Access Appeals Commission and how to find reasonable solutions for the things that make sense. You mentioned the word empirical. I think that's a good guideline. I think there's a lot of opportunity to do things to, go after the low-hanging grapes. What are the things that make sense that can be done that aren't cost prohibitive that would be good for people like the people that are here in the room today? So the good thing I think that's happened today is a lot of very good dialogue between the California Council for the Blind and also the elevator industry, which is outstanding. We happen to be fairly near San Francisco, which is a leading city for this new technology, for some of the same primal reasons that San Francisco is adopting this new technology are the same reasons why I think San Francisco is a good place to possibly improve the regulations that are required or that may even become voluntary. But I think that the things that make San Francisco a creative place, that make Northern California creative, are the same things that can help us improve destination elevators. And what I wanted to do is just specifically address some of the issues that came up to say that I think some of them are quite doable and some of them may be far off in the future. The raised numerals, I'm writing a specification right now for more elevator systems, and that's something that could be easily added. And I think it's already in A117 anyway. And I think one of the companies does it as a standard anyway, but it could easily be done. Just changing out buttons to make them raised and not recessed for the numerals is easy to do. Adjacency has gotten a lot of discussion for the reasons that have been mentioned. My feeling as an elevator expert is that the idea has very good merit, and there's a reasonable way to do adjacency. And actually, I'm considering putting it in a specification that we're working on right now, just based upon the comments I've had this week and today. I think it's a very good idea. It's something that can be done easily. Elevator dispatchers are very sophisticated. Yes, there are trip time trade-offs and other trade-offs if elevators are out of service, but I think that idea does have merit. Other things like refreshable braille probably are going to be in the short term cost prohibitive, but they obviously are going to deserve discussion in the future. There were a number of key points that I'm well aware of that I think are very important in terms of wayfinding. That is, what do you do in a multi-group building with four groups of eight elevators? How do you know which ones are the low rise, which are low intermediate, which are the high intermediate, and which floors they serve? That's very difficult, I would think, for somebody who can't necessarily see how the elevator groups are demarcated 15 feet above the floor, to say that this group serves 1 through 16 and this group serves 17 through whatever, 32, as we have in many buildings. So I think the wayfinding issues go beyond destination elevators, but the gentleman over here that asked the question about how to wayfind beyond the elevator group, I think that was a very legitimate question. It requires coordination between architects and elevator designers. And likewise, just the wayfinding in general, in terms of how that's going to be done, in terms of tactile symbols, in terms of audible signals, there's a lot of merit to discussing that further. I did want to mention that Josh had indicated he was in a building where there was no tones on upper floors, and it's my understanding, it's one of my projects, that the tones were not working. I think we had an amplifier speaker board problem, and those tones should have worked on the upper floors just as they did on the lower floors. So that was just an equipment malfunction, which I think has since been fixed. In terms of where we're going with regulation, I'll just tell you from my perspective, I basically work for the building owners. And the owners in general, in fact, I have a number of owners that are basically multimillionaires, and they have handicaps. They have impairments, and so they may, in fact, have interest in some of these things. It's normally not the first thing we talk about, but I think that there is going to be a lot of interest on behalf of a lot of the building owners about these things. My general guideline going forward with this, because I do need to see the approval process go forward for many of these buildings in San Francisco, which house literally tens of thousands of workers in the city, is to do things that make sense, that are smart, that are reasonable, that are practical, that are the best, you know, for the short term and best for the long term, and hopefully we'll be able to get there. The last thing I would like to suggest to, and I want to mention about the universal remote. I think that idea was discussed many years ago when I worked at Otis. That's also independent of destination systems, but the idea that somebody could call an elevator and get some assistance with wayfinding and calling the elevator with some universal device probably is something that could be done. The technology obviously exists today. The question I see is more of a structural one about how things get invested in and paid for. Where does the money come to make that happen, and how do we get building owners to basically pay for that, and how do we get elevator companies to put money into developing that? Yeah, you could. Yes. I'm not going to say that we can do that today, but technology absolutely exists to do that. And that's, in fact, a very smart idea. So there are a lot of very good things came up. What I got out of this today, I'm not visually impaired. I'm not hearing impaired. I was hit by a car a year and a half ago. I do see myself, though, as somebody in the future who will have impairments. And I have older parents. I have relatives and friends who have impairments. And I definitely believe in the significance of these issues. I look at the buildings I'm working on today. 50 years from now or 40 years from now, if I'm still around, I'm going to be in those same buildings, and it won't be the same for me then as it is now. So in many ways, I look at what I'm doing now as buildings I'm going to have to navigate through later in my life when it's not the same as it is now for me. And so I think that the big picture perspective on this, I think, is the right way to look at it. The last thing I wanted to suggest is that it absolutely makes sense to go visit these buildings with destination. This is basically the biggest change in high-rise building elevatoring since the elimination of the elevator attendant. And so it is significant. It is coming. It's basically coming for tall buildings. Buildings of 20 floors or more is where you're going to start seeing this. It is a better system, I believe, for people that do have more challenging issues with wayfinding and with impairments. And the reason is basically that this elevator system allows for individual interaction. You can talk to the system as a one-on-one, and you can ask for the things that it gives you if you have a disability. It gives you a longer dwell time. Which all programmable. Doors can stay open longer. Doors can close more slowly. The walking speeds are different. If you hit the access button, by the way, that word can be added to that button quite easily. That's one of the things that's easy to do in Braille. That is a programmable speed. So when we set up a building, we discuss what is the walking speed. Is it 200 feet a minute? Is it 100 feet a minute? What were the distances you have between the keypads and the different elevators? All those things can be programmed, and they all can be made to work well. The technology has to be implemented properly. Again, the point being that destination dispatch allows for individual interaction with people. If they want it, they can get a higher level of service. That's the bottom line, really, with respect to accessibility, I think, and destination. Finally, in San Francisco, strongly suggest to go visit some of the buildings. I've worked on a number of them, but the ones that are finished and ready to look at, I think, if I'll just throw some addresses out, because people are asking what buildings, 1 California Street, 650 California Street, 111 Pine, and 475 Sansom are all finished. They're up and running. They're good to see. I think some of the experts here have already seen them. The first two I mentioned are by Schindler. The last two are by Otis. There are no other companies that have destination systems running in San Francisco, but there will be others. I'm sitting right now next to a gentleman from Mitsubishi. He's had their people out from Japan. I've met with them. They're going to be designing a system. That's why they're here listening today. And we're going. And we've had inquiries from all of the other companies, Kone, Thyssen, Motion Control, all to do destination systems. So it is coming, and the input of this community is going to be extremely valuable in making progress. And I will follow up in particular with Josh and Jesse, because I do need to talk to them about some of the specifics. And I'm done. Thank you.
I want to thank you for those comments, and if I could also get your card. Just so that's clarification for those of you from the elevator industry, the three organizations, the Lighthouse for the Blind is a rehabilitation service provider, works with persons with visual impairments, sometimes multiple disabilities. The Smith Cutowell Eye Institute is a research facility and works on issues impacting persons with visual impairments. And the California Council of the Blind is a consumer organization, the people actually with the visual impairment, and those with low vision who speak for themselves. And so we all three entities want to be involved, particularly since we all, and the council actively lobbies and gets works with the Division of State Architect to introduce legislation. So we all want to be worked. It makes very great sense, being in San Francisco, that you all work together in refining what it is, but also include our local people as well as the state organization. We have a committee on access and transportation, which I chair, and many of us on that represent the organization on these issues on the state and national level, and we involved with our parent organization, American Council of the Blind. So if I could get everyone's from the industry that's present, their business card, I'd like that for the council, and I know that Jesse and Josh would be also interested in getting the contact information for others so we could share and start dialoguing. Thank you. And I would like everyone, if you're still interested, I believe both Otis and Schindler have a demo, and we're going to have them give them a minute to set up at either end of the table on the right and left of the podium so you could get an, actually some experience or something that's close to what it is like in a real environment. But just before that, let's all give our panelists a big hand.